Do you think that the future of customer education will be card catalogs?
In my dreams.
We didn't talk about that.
We didn't.
Okay, we'll leave it on that thinker.
You've heard the buzzword for years. Scale onboarding. CSMs shouldn't be doing training. Digital is a strategy, not a segment. But here's the truth. Most customer success teams are juggling a mess of tools, changing priorities, and have barely enough bandwidth to breathe, let alone scale. That vision we've all been chasing, it is finally real. Learning isn't trapped inside an LMS anymore. It's embedded across the entire customer journey. And that's where Skilljar, now a part of Gainsight, is changing the game. Skilljar is becoming the backbone of scalable self-serve learning, whether it's in your academy, inside your product, in your community, or beyond. And because it's integrated with Gainsight's customer OS, it connects to where your customer data and your CSMs already live. This isn't theory, it is happening now. Companies like Airtable, Zendesk, Okta, Miro, and Asana are already doing it, with Skilljar and Gainsight leading the charge. So if you're ready to stop duct taping your customer education strategy together, visit Skilljar.com today.
Welcome to C-Lab, the customer education lab, where we explore how to build customer education programs, experiment with new approaches, and send the myths and bad advice that stop growth dead in its tracks to the Viking funeral that it deserves. At sea, with fire, flaming arrows, the whole thing. I am your host, a heavily congested Adam Avramescu, but despite that, I am still very happy to be here to join Bessie Weiss. Hello, Bessie.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us from the Webflow studio, which we're going to have to do at least a YouTube posting of this one because we don't always post them. But The fact that you're joining us from what I consider to be a very famous studio and now a piece of the customer education canon is that's a real treat.
Yeah, it's iconic.
It is iconic. I love iconic. Bessie, before we get started, because I'm going to ask you some questions about yourself to kick us off. But first, I have to ask you a question.
Okay.
What's your favorite section of the Dewey Decimal System?
Oh, can I say the card catalog? I know that's not what you're asking. I do understand.
No, I don't. I don't expect you to know off the top of your head all the time.
But I miss card catalogs. That's how I used to.
I miss them
find
a little
stuff.
Bit too. Yeah. It's National Dewey Decimal System Day, and I was wondering, like, is that even something that's relevant anymore? Because we don't use card catalogs anymore, and because we're like at least. You're searching in a terminal, but I think probably a lot of people these days are using AI altogether and not even like using a library properly.
That's true. Although we had a conversation with my team last week about taxonomies and the importance of taxonomies for organizing our content and also making it findable. So I don't think that
we also have a taxonomy for how our product is set up. So yeah, maybe you're right. Yeah. Maybe it's not completely going away.
Yeah, not yet anyway.
But librarian friends, if you are listening, because I know we have some people coming from a library science background who listen to the show, please let us know. Let us know what's up with the Dewey Decimal System. Is it still around? Do people use it? What's your opinion on the Library of Congress system? That's all my
now,
Dewey Decimal.
Now
material.
You're getting controversial.
Yeah, exactly. Let's get a little spicy. Well, you know what I say. No taxonomy without representonomy.
I've heard you say that many times.
Okay, I'll be here all night. Don't forget to tip the bartenders. We were just talking about backgrounds that people come to this world from. And actually, I don't want to miss the opportunity to transition because you also come to this world from a really interesting background. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I always say that I've lived at the intersection of education and technology with content used to be something I called out, but at this point, I think it's just assumed. But I've worked at that intersection and from lots of different directions. So textbook publishing, online boot camps, customer education kind of a whole bunch of different places. And I actually fell into customer education almost accidentally. It never occurred to me that this was a whole different thing. And I got a job leading a customer education team without realizing the subtle differences. But the reality is the thing that drives me and that's consistent about all of this is that what we're doing is creating experiences that help people improve their lives. And, you know, that's whether you're a student in a school reading a textbook, whether you're starting a new career and learning a skill to start a career, or whether you're working for a company and your career mat, like the technology that you're using is going to make you more successful at your job. It's really about the people at the other end.
And it's true, like to some extent, like we get really into the, oh, customer education and L&D are different for these reasons. Mm-hmm. Andragogy and pedagogy are different for these reasons, right? Yeah. We can get into all these nuanced debates about it, but at the end of the day, it is still like a close enough overlap in terms of skills and experiences that, like, for instance, when I first became an instructional designer and was working on courses for clients, my friends all said like, oh, you write textbooks, right?
Uh-huh.
So exactly. I guess I also come from a publishing background.
Exactly. We all do at the core of things. And, you know, funnily enough, when I worked in textbook publishing, I joined to build technology ancillaries. I was a technology project manager, and they were very ancillary to the books. We were doing, dating myself here, but we were making CDs and websites and like super basic stuff. And in the 6 years that I worked in the space, it evolved into the textbook industry really needing to figure out what to do about use textbooks and like how to kind of address that and much more sophisticated technology. And it ultimately, by the time I left, the technology was the core product. And so it was kind of an interesting transition. And also a transition for me in terms of my career, because I started as an individual contributor and I ultimately, by the time I left, I was a director and running this big team of people who were developing both textbooks and technology products. So it was a fascinating experience and all directly applicable to everything I've done since.
Yeah, because then you were in a variety of leadership roles across like KM, like knowledge management. I try not to say acronyms. Knowledge management, content, customer education, and now you are senior director of customer education at Webflow. Is that correct?
That is correct. That is correct. I joined Webflow. I started consulting with them about 2 years ago, and I joined full time a few months after I started consulting. So. Yeah.
That's often the way in, right? It's like you get a taste and then you're like, maybe we should escalate this.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's an interesting place for us to start our conversation as well, right? Because you came into Webflow at a time where the company was making a transition and therefore the education program was also making a transition. And so I'd love to zoom in on that, because if I think of Webflow, at least at that time, like Webflow was one of the big PLG, product-led growth companies out there. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people who listen to us know what product-led growth is, but maybe we can actually, do you want to talk briefly about what that is?
Sure. So if you think of it from the perspective of somebody using your product as a way of determining, of making the sale, versus having a sales rep who's out there making the sale based on kind of what works about the product. And so it has education has a direct impact on that.
Yeah, you have like individual users signing up and are sort of responsible for using more of the product and expanding over time. And you contrast that like PLG with sales-led or enterprise or doing these, you know, big deal cycles where you go to the pricing page and it's like, call us to see the pricing.
Yes.
And you can't sign up yourself. Which, like, I know annoys a lot of people in the PLG world, but there's certainly a reason for it.
Yeah.
So like Webflow is making that transition, right? From being this like established PLG company and having a lot of, to your point, like PLG related education and marketing and things like that, to then needing to build an enterprise program within that. So I don't know exactly where you want to come into that from. Maybe we can talk a little bit about how you see those more generally, like how does education reflect PLG versus enterprise? And then we can zoom in specifically to what that meant for you coming in to, I guess, at first consult with Webflow.
Yeah. So, and I think it's a kind of tracks back to exactly what we were talking about. It's not different people necessarily. It's the context in which you're learning. And so what Webflow University did an excellent job of was meeting people who were looking to start new careers, develop new skills, or apply those skills, and letting them learn how to do that in Webflow. And then really build their career off of that. And I think when you think about product-led growth, what you're trying to do is you're trying to get people into your product and successful with your product so that they decide it's the right tool for them. I just want to be really clear about Webflow. Like, that hasn't changed. We continue to have, we continue to be a product-led growth company in addition to now being an enterprise company. And so the consulting work that they brought me in for was to think about, like, strategically, how do we make that shift? And the challenge, of course, is you can't leave people behind, but you also have to be building for people learning in a very different context. And when you're thinking about an enterprise, the education is usually happening after the sale has been made. Often, people learning your product are not the people who made the decision to buy the product. And they're learning it within a narrower context, right? Like, they're working with their team. And so somebody might be a designer, somebody might be a developer, somebody might be a marketer, whereas oftentimes we have freelancers who are kind of wearing multiple hats and learning kind of end to end the product. We're now really focusing on people who may have a much narrower context. They may have the exact same skills that they're applying in Webflow, but kind of it's the context of where they're learning and what they need to learn about.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Makes a lot of sense. I would, to me, it sounds very similar to Slack, right? When I came into Slack, Slack was also a very established, well, as much as a company that's, you know, only been around for so long, like, you know, we're still in the startup scale-up world.
Yeah.
That reminds me a lot of the experience that I had at Slack, because Slack was this also, again, like an extremely product-led growth company. You had individual people and individual teams signing up to start their own Slack workspaces. And maybe even within like a large enterprise, for instance, you might have multiple teams, but they're not connected to each other.
Yeah.
So that, like, even though it's the same people using it, the same people trying to get value out of collaborating with each other, it's different to say, what if we have, you know, all these different teams within a large enterprise versus, hey, if we are trying to get a company like IBM, for instance, up and running and really successful with Slack, what do we need to teach them, not just about how to use this product, but about how they're going to be working together as an enterprise in this product? Like, that strikes me as maybe one of the key differences.
Yeah, exactly. And they don't necessarily need to understand the full scope of everything. They need to understand the pieces that are relevant to them so that they can be as efficient and as successful as possible in their jobs. Yeah.
Yeah. And to your point, they can coexist, right? You can have even large teams sometimes where you're doing some things to educate the entire account. And, like, you know, you've got this like enterprise motion going on, you're selling into an account, but then you've still got all of these like individual lines of business and individual teams, and you can sell to them, you can educate them, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things that is the same is, so I mean, I talked about applying existing skills, but there is still the need to have that contextual story. Like, what is this product? Why does it matter? How can you use it to be more successful? And that part of the learning is very important no matter who it is that you're educating or where it is that you're kind of meeting them on their journey. It's also still relevant for somebody who, even in an enterprise space, who may be trying to decide whether to buy your product. So it can, you know, it applies in different ways, and it might be slightly different context or slightly different audience, right? It might be an executive who would be watching it. And so they might have a different perspective on it, but there's definitely a lot of overlap and a lot of opportunities to really think about like, oh, this is relevant no matter who you are. And then there is that question of efficiency. What does somebody need to know? And how do you, we're all busy. We have a million things and a million different tools and technologies that we're required to use to do our jobs. And so being really respectful of that and finding that balance is the challenge.
Yeah, for sure. And I think we'll come back and talk about that more. But then
sure.
I'm also interested, you know, like as we kind of zoom into you coming into Webflow and now one being tasked with, I guess, building an enterprise motion within a PLG company. So they're going to coexist, but one's established and one's new.
Yeah.
And at the same time, also from an education perspective, like the thing I would reflect back to you is, I think, again, Webflow has had a pretty like iconic customer education program on the PLG side for a long time. So maybe compared to some situations where you walk in as the first customer education leader and you're building everything from scratch, you also inherited quite a bit of goodness. So I'm just curious what that whole experience was like for you.
Yeah. And there's, you know, it's a double-edged sword. And I talk to the team about this all the time. Coming in to something that is beloved, both internally and externally. I mean, we have a very vocal community, which is one of our strengths as a company, and actually was a Webflow University was a big part in building that. It also means that you have to be careful, right? Like if you come into a typical enterprise customer education program, even if it exists, people don't care as much about that education. Like they're going to come in, they're going to take it, they're going
to
leave.
My boss told me to use this. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know. Am I allowed to curse on this?
Yeah. You've now given fair warning. So anyone who has kids, there's a category B swear coming in 3, 2, 1.
So, I mean, the woman who's now our CEO, Linda Tong, said to me when she brought me in was, you know, you need to make it better, but don't fuck it up. And so that's kind of my mantra.
That was a category A swear, but, sorry.
Should I rewind? I can child friendly.
Yeah, no, like we're going to treat the rest of this, one as like damn hell ass kings as Bart Simpson would say.
Okay, there we go. But I mean, I think about that all the time, right? Like, so we had a need to really scale. And there's so much goodness in Webflow University. Like if you watch our videos, I can say this because I wasn't responsible for kind of building this program in the first place. They are really extraordinary education. Like they are outstanding pieces of content, and they do a great job at what they're supposed to do. And so there really is an opportunity to mess something up.
Mm-hmm. Well, you already said it. It's not like YouTube where we can only say it once. You know,
like. and at the same time, the reason that existed and the reason that was possible was because the team came from a culture of creating everything being pixel perfect. And it shows, and it mattered to the audience that we were speaking to. And so figuring out how do we scale, because we have to build a lot more content because we have a lot more audiences we need to address now. Also, frankly, our product is updating and evolving so fast. And how do we do that without losing that thing that made it so great in the first place? That's been kind of an interesting journey. I've been very lucky that the team that built this studio, that built all of that content, I inherited them and they know what they're doing. And so I can lean, they're literally leaning into them right now for this recording. And then how do you kind of take that and figure out, okay, what does it look like to scale? How do we apply this other ways of approaching education that I'm used to in order to help us meet this broader set of audiences, this new set of audiences, and kind of what it is that they're hoping for and expecting. And I will say we haven't done a perfect job at it yet. We're still figuring it out nearly 2 years later, but I think we've definitely have a really strong sense of what matters. What are the things, like, you know, maybe pixel perfect isn't the thing that matters the most. What matters is, and the thing I keep saying, is the authenticity of the people who you're watching. It feels like you're in this room with people who are actually working with each other and who actually like each other. And sometimes they're funny and that's great. But if you're learning, that's so much more enjoyable than listening to very, very dry audio and, you know, or even very stiff people on camera. And, you know, so that's the, like, that's kind of the thing that we've kind of figured out. Okay, what do we need to keep? And then how do we scale this so that we can build out a whole lot of content a lot faster and meet the needs of our, of all of our audiences at the same time?
Yeah, because I think that's worth just, you know, hammering home for a moment. Like, I think when you don't think about it too hard, you might think, oh, like, we want to build this iconic customer education program. We want to have our own Webflow University. And,
mm-hmm.
and I know that a lot of teams come in and they set something like that as their vision, right? Because the first question that a lot of exec sponsors ask when they want to charter a program like this is,
mm-hmm.
who should we look to in the world? Who is doing this really well?
Yeah.
And I think to that point, you're not always thinking upfront about the trade-offs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what I hear you calling out right now. And this resonates with me a lot, where if you want, like, the more you anchor on the side of really high production value and everything being pixel perfect, as you're saying, like, of course, mm-hmm. you're going to get really high quality, but it comes at a cost. And that cost is speed, as you called out. It's
mm-hmm.
keeping pace with your product, and especially mm-hmm. in, like, SaaS and AI products, they're moving faster than anyone can keep up with.
Yes.
So, and the actual, like, human costs, like, you know, mm-hmm. you just called out your excellent video team, and that's a skill, that's a specialty, that's not just something that, like, someone with no knowledge of video production is going to throw together in an afternoon. So I would think, like, you have to treat that as an investment and understand, like, mm-hmm. when we're going to use that sort of really high quality video production, how do we do that? But at the same time, then we also have, what I'm hearing is, and again, like, I'd say this has been true in a lot of situations I've been in too, this enterprise motion where it's like, people want you to go faster. They don't care as much about the polish. They want things more customized and maybe bespoke to them. And what does this mean for my situation and my account? And then, naturally, you're not necessarily going to be able to keep going, like, at the quality bar that you were going at. So now you have to make some really, like, tough decisions about, even if you have these values set up, which level of production do you use for what? Which strategy do you use for what? So I'd love to hear, like, kind of how you architected the team then, and maybe even, like, some of the changes you made as you were coming in to help drive those strategic goals and kind of reflect that evolution.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so I have, like, so many thoughts about everything you were just saying. So first of all, I think one of the things that was really interesting and also I think is part of the difference between potentially a product-led growth company and an enterprise company is that there was a much blurrier line between marketing and education with what the team was creating. And I say that because, frankly, Webflow University was the top of the funnel in terms of, like, people found Webflow often through Webflow University. What we were doing, what they were doing, was indeed education. Did somebody else just join?
Yep, we got a little cameo from Dave. Hi, Dave. Bye, Dave.
Why?
Dave, that you're going to have to cut this up.
That was...
Okay, Fessy, get the clapboard.
Okay, wait, hold on. This has been...
Okay.
This is
take... back to one.
Four. Okay. So one of the things that we kind of did is said, okay, we actually need to be really clear and specific about when we're doing education and when we're doing marketing. We're now a company that's at a size and a maturity where we need to be really clear about that. And frankly, I am not in marketing. I should not be in marketing. And so I wanted to be really careful about that. So part of the team that existed previously joined my org, and part of the team joined, but actually stayed with the marketing org because that's where they had been living for a little while. And then I was looking at, okay, I need people who can come in and who know how to scale education. So we have this video production team. We need some instructional designers, and I have an interesting relationship with the instructional design. I think it's an incredible art and science, and so valuable. And also, I like to be a little bit flexible with the way you apply it, because the thing that matters most to me is this helping somebody?
Let's zoom in on that for a moment, because I think like there was a lot of subtext in what
you
just said.
I'm going to alienate everybody here.
No. Like, by the way, I'm the same way too, because mm-hmm. there are some people out there who uh-huh. kind of have their own, like Pixel Perfect might almost be like mm-hmm. the right framing device for this too, right? Like there yeah. some people want to take the point of view that, hey, there's all of this learning science out there. There's all of these studies that have been done. There are all these concepts that are available to us.
Yeah.
So why don't we, like, we need to do it this way. Otherwise we're doing it wrong. Like capital W.
Yes. Yes.
Wrong.
Yes.
But what I hear you saying, and I agree with you, is that if you bring yourself like too close to saying these instructional design principles and like these studies and this mm-hmm. research is the only way mm-hmm. to do it, then you're probably going to end up like slowing yourself down. You're probably going to end up making the wrong investments. You're probably going to end mm-hmm. up doing something that like is like quote unquote right, but doesn't resonate with your customers. So like
exactly
the way I always think about this is like we kind of follow that stuff because like dogmatically, because we think it's sort of like the way we get credibility in our field. But I think mm-hmm. it's like looking mm-hmm. for credibility in all the wrong places.
Interesting. Yeah, I think that the thing you need to anchor back to again and again is your audience. And a really good example of this is when I was working at a company that did all online cloud computing training, and nobody on my team was an instructional designer. They were all engineers who were also good mm-hmm. at teaching. And the thing that was really surprising to me in that job that was different than when I had been working in textbook publishing with instructional designers was they were like, no, engineers don't want it to be like Pixel Perfect. Like they won't trust the video if it feels like it's overproduced. Yeah, they want it to feel like this is an engineer talking to another engineer, and also that it's timely. And so there hasn't been like a ton of like production energy put into it, but that you've gotten them information quickly. And they're used to like self-teaching themselves because they're constantly having to learn. And it was really fascinating. Yeah. So understanding your audience and what resonates with them and what's meaningful to them is really important. And a really good example of that at Webflow is this question of humor, which comes up a lot. Because that's one of the things that Webflow University is known for, it uses humor, and it's an incredibly engaging tool. But if I am a developer and I've been told I have to use this new tool and I have to apply my skills and I need to learn what this tool is, I may or may not enjoy the humor. I may just want to get to the point and figure out what yeah. I'm doing. And so finding that balance and understanding your audience is really important. And that's true in terms of like how we produce our videos. And it's also true in terms of like how we apply instructional design and understanding who that audience is and understanding, yes, this is best practice. And also, this is how it needs to flex or adapt. Like rigidity is the enemy of education as far as I'm concerned. And that's
I yeah. would agree. Yeah, it's knowing your persona and knowing your audience. The thing that yeah. I had always heard about developers when I first started getting into this world and then I started talking to them. And well, the thing I'd always heard is like developers don't want to deal with any of that stuff. Like they don't want video. They just want to read the docs, right? They want to read the docs and get yeah. on with their day.
Yeah. And
the more I started talking to developers, like, it's kind of true,
mm-hmm.
but it's a little bit more nuanced than that, right? Because as it turns out, everyone is an individual and you can't just like create a generic customer persona.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you don't want to be doing something that like patently misses the mark. Like where if like the humor is humor that kind of like appeals to, I don't know, someone in marketing or something like that. Well, developers aren't necessarily going to find like the same types of stuff funny if they can't relate to it or if it feels like it's wasting their time.
Yeah.
Like
absolutely.
Maybe compared to like learning from someone who is like in your world, is another developer, they have credibility, and like mm-hmm. if they want to crack some developer jokes, well,
exactly.
That's different.
Exactly. Developer to developer. Yeah, and really kind of understanding like who it is that you're speaking to and what matters to them. I think there's definitely a component of that. And then figuring out how you kind of blend that and bring what is really valuable in what you do and apply it in other places has been a big part of like how we've built this team and you know figured out like how does this work. So we now have an instructional design team and we have the video production team and they work really, really closely together. But definition around when do we create high production value video? What does it mean to have much lower production video embedded in a course when you're on Webflow University and people may have certain expectations? What does it mean to have more than just video on your university? And, you know, when that's kind of what it is that people maybe expect, but you're also now speaking to more audiences and how do you kind of make that all work together as, you know, a team of humans and as, you know, a university that's a brand in the world that people are experiencing and using and lots of different people are experiencing and using.
Yeah.
Okay, so you asked me about the structure of the team. So the team I put together was, so we had the video team. And let me also say this. I say to people all the time, like I was a little bit overwhelmed by inheriting this team because I feel like this studio and this level of production that you get is what you put together after you're generating like millions and millions of dollars in revenue. And like, it's not typically where I'm used to starting.
So it's like also when you inherit like a top of funnel marketing team, then all of a sudden you're like, oh, wait, you're working with what budget?
Like, yeah, exactly. And then so we built out a curriculum organization. We have our platform and experience org. So it's a developer and a designer and essentially a product manager who leads them. I hired somebody to build out our certifications program, and we can talk about that in more detail. And then we actually inherited, so the customer success org built out an onboarding program because mm-hmm. Webflow University wasn't sort of addressing this enterprise onboarding need. And so, you know, like had, and it was sort of unclear how to make that transition quickly. And so they just built out a program and I ended up inheriting those folks. And we just launched a new program that kind of really expanded that a lot more. But that's the kind of the structure of my work at this point. Yeah.
Very cool. And yeah, it sounds like you're expanding your portfolio now to be able to kind of trade in both worlds, right? Some of the end user, some of the enterprise. And of course, like you've said, that's a porous boundary. So I am curious, maybe before we start talking about some of those more specific programs, like you sort of described it as like the ongoing struggle to figure out where that boundary exists, both from your team side and from the customer side. But like, even if it's kind of like early, raw, still in progress thoughts, like I'd love to hear about how you are approaching that challenge from both the internal and the customer side.
In terms of like when we do what kind of content.
Exactly.
And like, yeah. So, and I will say it's not early and raw. It's more like if you asked me 3 months ago, I'd have had a different answer. And if you ask me in 3 months, it'll be a different answer because we're trying things and evolving and iterating. And that, you know, with that caveat. But kind of the way we have been thinking about it is that sort of higher level strategic content that's really important and valuable is also more evergreen. And that's, mm-hmm. I mean, the reality is video is not easily updatable. And so we've been leaning into using the high production value video for that type of content. And then really thinking about the product education and kind of building out the fundamentals of what you need in order to be successful with our product. And I clarify this every time I say fundamentals. I don't mean intro. I mean, end-to-end, what are the things that people need to know to be successful with your product? And that includes advanced content as well for our developers and for designers. And so we've been kind of leaning into the curriculum team to focus on and the instructional design team to focus on those pieces and building out a very clear roadmap of like, we're going to deliver these learning pathways. We're going to deliver this content. And then leaning into the video team on more of the higher level strategic video. So, you know, perfect example, we made a series of videos recently about AEO, which is kind of
AI SEO, right?
Yeah, exactly. Answer engine optimization. We all had to record ourselves doing this sales pitch. Mm-hmm. So I can say to you, your website is now speaking to two audiences, the humans who visit your website and the bots in the background who are reading it. But like really thinking about that, that is conceptual. You know, understanding it is really important before you start implementing it in Webflow, which is, by the way, a great tool for, I really did just have to do a pitch, a sales pitch on this.
Do we have a discount code or?
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, actually, there is a free version of Webflow.
Okay, you too can have the PLG experience with Webflow if you sign up.
Start with Webflow University and learn everything you need. The way we kind of approached it was, this is at a high level what you need to think about and what you need to understand and why this matters to your organization and what your organization may be kind of really struggling with, which really toes a delicate line between marketing and education, and then bringing it into how do you apply that? How do you apply that in terms of actually building out a program? Clearly education. And then how do you apply that specifically within our product as your tool? And so we kind of really focused on the education team on being able to do that. Some part of what we're trying to do as well is maybe counterintuitive, but because of the velocity at which we're all moving, we still need to have a really clear and reliable roadmap of content that we're going to be building out. That's just kind of a need we need internally and externally. But there are going to be more and more of those. Oh, can you do this for me next week? And so one of the things I've been trying to figure out is there a way to build a moat around the people who need to be able to just deliver and know what they're doing and not get pulled in multiple directions all the time? And then have folks whose job it is to say, oh, there's this new thing that's coming out. Our product org built an entire new AI tool over the weekend. Yes, that did happen. And now we need to create education around it. You know, or AEO is this new thing that's really actually becoming noisier and noisier. And actually, really, we can play an important role here. And there's a really exciting opportunity to educate people about this. And how do we kind of create the space for us to be able to do that without, you know, pulling the entire team in multiple directions at the same time? And so that's how those are sort of the ways we've been thinking about it is like, okay, we know this is the content we have to build. We have to build content for developers, and we need to give them everything they need kind of end to end to be successful with our product. We need to build out content for designers and for marketers, and we need to be able to build out content that it makes people successful in each of these parts of our product. That we know. I could tell you what's included in that today, and so we can prioritize and schedule that out. That is different than we have this sudden opportunity, or we have brand new product that is actually really meaningful. And how do you kind of do both of those things at the same time? And so thinking about the video production org versus the instructional design org as a somewhat false, but kind of delineation between those two things. We still need the video production org to also create video for our instructional right. design team. So it's not clean.
Yeah, but there's almost like three categories of thing in there. There's there's like the things you're planning for, because yes. you know they're on the roadmap, or you know they're coming, right? And you talked about that. Yeah. But then there's like two things I'm hearing within that reactive category.
Mm-hmm.
One is like it's reactive because something just came to you, or like the product team just released a product, something like that. You weren't expecting it. You're a little bit on your heels. But then there's this like second category of reactive or unexpected, where it's like something is changing in the market and we need yes. to have a point of view on that. And here, what I'm hearing is like, there's also a little bit of a delineation here between what are we trying to educate? Who are we trying to educate, and what are we trying to educate them to do? Yeah. And how can we find the right format and level of production that meets sort of like both of those criteria? If it's on the roadmap and it's being planned and we can kind of, we know it's something that is not going to be, say, like super disposable, then of course, like we can look ahead and plan a higher production value asset against that.
Yeah.
And we know that this thing will be around. But if it's disposable, or sorry, if it's reactive, what I'm hearing is like, then you also sort of have to think about like, is this also something that we're going to have to kind of like keep iterating our way yeah. towards over time? Or is this something that's like disposable because, you know, the next weekend the product team can produce like, you know, V2 of that same AI
And they will.
Asset, right? And you're going to have to like go update all of that stuff anyway. And if you're
exactly.
educating a developer, for instance, on how to be good at that, like they don't even want the high production video. So,
well, let me say this. Webflow developers are not AWS developers. Like they're two very different beasts, because Webflow developers, and I almost feel like we've created this like third category, which has been one of the interesting challenges in that the specificity of your audience, but creative yeah. developers or technical designers, right? Like they're melding the skill sets a little bit.
Yeah.
And
no, like Slack developers are very similar, right? Because yeah. like they're all thinking about the like interaction design.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I just want to be really clear. The Pixel Perfect does matter to the developers working in Webflow. And that's kind of to my point. Like you have to be able to flex, and you have to be able to sort of meet people where they are and who are you yeah. speaking to and understand that. But yes, the thing I said about being counterintuitive is, even though our video is really high production value, we also have this studio set up so that the team yeah. can walk in, film a video, and create something pretty extraordinary, and get it out relatively quickly. And so even yeah. though it's really high production value and it's going to be really painful when we have to throw that away in a month, I'm getting looks. But, you know, I mean, if we do, right? And because of the way things are changing so fast, we probably will. We also yeah. have a different level of investment that we've had to make. And we have had to define different levels of investment, knowing, this is video that's probably going to go away very quickly. And this is video that yeah. we probably are going to be able to hang on to for a long time.
Yeah, and you can treat those in different ways. But I think, yeah. you know, to your point, like, number one, having the in-house studio is a huge competitive advantage for you yes. in that regard. Yes. And if you sort of want to like look at that triangle of speed, quality, and cost, are those the three that we always put in the triangle?
Uh-huh.
Like you're saying strategically, like, hey, we're willing to make a higher investment in this from a cost perspective to have a studio, to have a team of experts, so that we can move fast with quality.
I have a cheat on that, which is that the studio existed when I joined, so I don't have to invest that much
in
the studio.
Your CapEx is minimal. Yeah.
So I can focus on the speed and the quality and those trade-offs there. And I lucked into that.
I'm thinking of it more from a perspective of someone who might be coming in new and saying like, oh, we want to create Webflow University tomorrow.
You can't.
Well, what do we have to do to do that? Well, you have to invest.
And I feel like for a long time, you know, it didn't matter where you went to, folks would, like, your leadership would be like, oh, can I have Trailhead? And, you
everyone
know, it's like,
wants Trailhead. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, sure. When you're a however many billion dollar company and you have all the money in the world to invest in that. I mean, they have an enormous amount of resources. It's a little bit the same here, except we aren't that rich a company, but we made very, very conscious decisions to invest here. And now it's paying dividends for me. But I would not, if I were to start at a new company tomorrow, even if it was the next design company, I probably would not start with building out a studio. But that might be why you wouldn't want to hire me to start that team there. And rather, you'd want to hire me to start a different team and hire somebody who actually could do that.
You're lucky in the sense that you do have this set up already. And like, because almost like you mentioned, coming from a top of funnel marketing perspective where generally I think there's an expectation that things are going to be much higher quality and more pixel perfect and have a lot of personality and humor and all of that. Like, that was the DNA. I think a lot about what's the DNA that you have already, like when you walk into an organization, because very few of us start from complete scratch. Even if we're customer education person number one, there's still stuff that's been going on before that. And that stuff has DNA and your customers already have certain expectations. So I think getting to leverage that in a really interesting way where, even if you might not start there tomorrow, the fact that you have that and the fact that you already have customers with expectations like is both like, let's say, the headwind and the tailwind to how you would then set up a program. Because on one hand, you can't just stop doing what you're doing tomorrow and customers are like, well, what the hell damn ass happened to my
thank you for
these videos that I loved.
Yeah.
But also, and like, you also wouldn't want to like squander the ability to move fast and at high quality since now you already have it.
Right. And I mean, the cost piece of it really comes down to resources, right? Like, how many people literally do we have who can build this content out? And you know, do we have like, okay, we have enough people to build out this much content. If you want that much content and you want it to maintain that quality, we still do have like obviously cost issues that we have to deal with.
Sure.
I feel like you asked me a question a long time ago about kind of the when I got brought in to Webflow and thinking about that like transition from PLG to enterprise. Have we covered that? I just want to make sure we've actually like covered that, or if there was.
I think so, but like maybe that will bring us into there was one thing that you mentioned a while ago that I wanted to draw a thread on, which is, you know, one thing that you talked about thinking through was like, how do you set up the video team? How do you bring in instructional designers? But then you also mentioned certifications. And I think certifications are an interesting part of this whole paella of of programs that we have. Because like, certifications, first of all, can mean a lot of different things, but they also require often some investment based on like the level of stakes that you're doing the certification on. So can you tell me a little bit about how you approach that and maybe like what you were building towards in relation to that, you know, PLG enterprise split?
Yeah. And I mean, this is the perfect segue from the DNA thing, because I probably wouldn't have started with a certification program quite so soon, except that we had things in the market that we were referring to as certifications. And as we were making the shift into being an enterprise company and with the importance of our partner program, and I think like that's a really big part of this, it was really clear that if we wanted to make that shift, we were going to have certifications that had more meaning in the market than the ones that we had. So the ones we had were very low stakes. They were not proctored. They were completely free. You could Google your answers
Yeah. It's like that's the classic low stakes certification, right? It's like the certificate of completion or something like that.
Yeah. When I was consulting, I was like, okay, let me see if I can pass this by Googling my answers. And I did. And also not great. In some cases, not great questions, tied sometimes more to did you watch the video than to do you have the skill set? And so I prioritized
answer
it.
Answer B is none of the above. Answer C is all of the above. And
I
answer
know,
D is like school sucks.
School does suck sometimes. But really, I mean, that it made perfect sense as again, I kind of lucked into this thing that was we had a lot of data about the hunger in the market for certifications, right? Like, so we had something that really resonated with people. And then it was a question of how do we take it to the next level in terms of maturity? And so thinking about that, I might have taken more time with it, except that we had something that I felt like we needed to replace pretty quickly if we were going to make this move towards maturity. So I brought somebody on to build a certification program right away and spent some time really educating folks internally about, and not just internally, actually, frankly, at our conference externally about like the difference between a test and a certification and validating something that really validates your skills and your knowledge. So that was, you know, that's been an interesting journey. We launched our certification program in February, but along with our first certification, we've got the second one in beta now and coming very soon.
And they're like high stakes certifications, right?
Yeah, they're proctored. They're AI proctored. But yes, we did the whole job. Yes. the job task analysis, like end to end, you know, creating that blueprint, putting it all together, getting SMEs to write the questions, all of the thing. And then, you know, using psychometrics to make sure that we were asking good questions and that we were, you know, setting the right pass rate, all of those things, all of the things that make a certification valid, we've done. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that somebody whose background isn't in customer education, honestly, probably wouldn't have a knowledge about. And, you know, because in textbook publishing, if you work in a field where there's a certification at the end, it might matter, but it doesn't necessarily translate otherwise. And so really kind of thinking about how we help people understand the meaning. And what's been really fascinating is we have just a really engaged community, an incredible partner community. And one of the things that really validated this for me is when I was consulting and I was talking to our partners, they talked about wanting to up-level everybody in the ecosystem because they wanted to be competing on an even playing field. And so it was really interesting to think about the meaningfulness of having something that felt really valid to our existing community and to anybody who was now trying to establish themselves in this space.
I mean, that's really interesting. And I think like partners especially become often like the motivator to really go after some sort of credentialing or certification program. But I'm also, I'm interested because, I mean, well, there's a few different things that I'm thinking. One is certifications often have the same issue that we talked about earlier with instructional design, right? Where there's a lot of things that like you quote unquote have to do. And with certifications, it's a little bit more complicated because there are actually things you have to do to make a certification legally defensible.
Yeah,
but at the same time, like some of those things, like if you're a business stakeholder and you're sitting there going like, oh, and we have to do what? And we have to write the questions this way. And we have to, how do you kind of like toe the line between on one hand, not wanting to fall into that trap of, you know, just going completely by the book. But at the same time, like doing enough to actually have a certification that meets the needs that your customers would then expect, so like to be able to do what they need to do with that credential.
Yeah. So I think there were a couple of components to that. I mean, the first is the reality is like we're not a security company or a, you know, like the we do have a little bit more wiggle room in terms of like how rigorous. I mean, it needs to be rigorous, but like if something gets by, it's not like, you know,
yeah,
people's systems are going to come crashing down as a result. So yeah, that
I'm always saying, like, also like the cops are not going to come for you if you
exactly
if you, like, don't make it 100% legally defensible.
You're not going to launch like nuclear war missiles. There's a lot of things that we're not going to do. So I mean, the really oversimplified but truly accurate answer to this is I hired somebody amazing. And I mean, she has spent just a ton of time talking to our partners and talking to service providers and talking to people about what really matters. And that's been the focus. I mean, this theme that we keep coming back to, like, what matters to your audience? Like, what is meaningful to people as opposed to what is the right thing to do? And internal stakeholders as well, and really kind of spent a fair amount of time kind of understanding that and putting that together. And she's somebody who gets what it means to have a legally valid certification and also gets what it means to say, these are the things that matter and these are the things that we can be flexible about. And so, I mean, I like all credit to Shirley, like, she's been able to toe that line. And it is a delicate line. And I do think that lack of rigidity is a really important component. We had to get it up and out very quickly.
Yeah.
And I mean, just to give you a sense, she started in May. We launched our first beta exam on a brand new platform. So we had to go through all of procurement, actually getting the platform up and running, and then actually delivering the exam in September.
Yeah, that's super quick.
Yeah. So, you know, there were decisions that just had to be made. And sometimes that's a really great forcing function. what matters?
Yeah, you can't get like too focused on like, oh, we have to be rigid. We have to do it exactly the right way. No, in the end, the right way is the way that's going to be like still legally defensible if you need it to be, but like
exactly
in the hands of your customers. I am curious because I actually haven't launched a certification program at this point since 2019. So like I'm a little rusty in this area. Mm-hmm. I would imagine that at this point, like AI is playing a bigger role in things like item development and getting everything kind of like formatted correctly and distractors and all of that. You talked about AI proctoring, but like, can you tell me a little bit more about like how or if you're using AI from like an item development, content, et cetera perspective?
Yeah. So not to plug a platform, but we're using a platform to develop the exam end to end, including the proctoring. And so the way they have implemented AI is you still have humans going in and SMEs developing the questions, but the AI can give them feedback on those questions or make suggestions about other questions, or let you know that you've got the wrong, you know, distractors that are going to be a problem, and also does the first pass on the psychometrics. So they have a human who actually comes in and looks at it, but there's sort of AI kind of under the surface helping out, doing some authoring, but, you know, really, you know, I don't think we're quite there yet with the machines in terms of like the things like we're talking about that matter, which is, do you actually know this and can you actually do this? And AI can't yet use our product in that way. So people who are actually doing the job are in a much better position to write those questions. The AI is in a good position to help them make those questions well-written and valid.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, just like keeping that human in the loop in the sense that I would think like because AI can be vulnerable to hallucination, you really want to make sure that if the point of this is to write something that has like a level of expertise that someone is being tested on, you still need those SMEs to get in there. You still need to make sure that like what's being delivered to a customer and what they're being tested on is not inaccurate or being hallucinated. But
exactly,
AI to actually get things in the right format to get it to help like SMEs who don't know anything about psychometrics to get questions psychometrically valid, to help them with distractors and all of that. Like it seems to me like that could have also been a contributing factor in helping you ultimately be able to get to a launch quicker, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It's a skill set like any other, right? Video production is a very specialized skill set. Writing good questions is a very specialized skill set, but you need a subject matter expert to do it for you. So how do you kind of bring those two things together? And the AI helps with that.
I love these human in the loop AI stories because I really do think that's when it works best.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. So, go ahead.
Oh, no, please finish it
up. I was just going to say the thing I keep saying is AI is a tool. It's only as powerful as the hands that it's in. So if you have knowledge and skills, you're going to be able to use the AI to build something that is going to be much better than somebody who doesn't have your expertise using the exact same tool.
So something we haven't talked about yet is metrics. And this is something that we generally like to talk to for any customer education leader we talk to. But I'm curious, maybe this has like an additional layer of flavor and intrigue, because I think sometimes the metrics that matter to a PLG company and the metrics that matter to an enterprise company might feel a little bit different. So what are the metrics that actually matter to you these days? What are you tracking?
Yeah. Those are two different answers. What matters to me?
Okay.
What we're tracking.
Start with the one. Yeah. Start with whichever one you would like. I did the classic double-barreled question that a psychometrician would not let me actually say.
Yeah, of course. And I mean, the reality is, look, I don't think I've yet to work at a company, and I've worked actually for data companies where accessing the data you want is in customer education is simple, because the data that matters is the connection between what people are doing with your education and what's happening in your product, and making that connection is always challenging.
There's like so many joins and you don't necessarily have all the data sources coming to the same place. Like,
It belongs to different teams there's so many factors that go into that. I think about it in terms of what matters to leadership at this company. Is it revenue? Is it NPS? Is it, some other, is it like daily active users in our product? And those are, three examples of things that either matter or have mattered at different companies that I work at. And then looking at, what is the usage of the education content? And can we tie that to those metrics that matter to the company? There's leading metrics, which are the ones that I say we have direct control over, like traffic to the university, consumption of the content, completion rates. I'm not a big fan of completion rates because I always come back to efficiency. If they got what they needed in 30 seconds, great.
It's not a mandatory L&D, sexual harassment training or something.
Right, exactly, which is very different than I need to use this tool. And then some level of rating of quality, like this met my needs or didn't meet my needs. Although that really, I think, gets answered by, are you using our product? Are you buying more of our product? Are you renewing your contract with us? Are you saying you're satisfied with our product? Are you talking about an easier learning curve than you might have previously? Like, all of those things are really the things that ultimately matter. That's why we're doing this. We're not doing this because we want lots of people to watch our videos. We're doing this because we want lots of people to use our product. That connection is the piece that I always look for and is always very challenging. And so it becomes a balance between what can we get today easily, and what do we actually want to get, and what is going to be most meaningful to the people who make decisions about our budgets and our livelihoods. That might be one of the things that AI finally gets us to, where we can get a lot more of that connection more easily. I do also want to say this, because I get this question always. It's like, but there's no direct correlation. Just because they're using education and they're successful with your product, how do you know it's education? And you don't. And I don't care. If I can tell a CSM, customers who use education are more likely to renew, or I can tell a customer that, whether it's because they're more invested in us as a product and that's why they're using the education, or because the education is the magic that is making them successful with our product, like it doesn't matter. It gives people the information they need. These people are more successful with our product. These are the things they're doing. And this is what the impact is. And that's kind of how I look at it. So maybe it's because of education, maybe not.
No, I mean, like, amen to that. I always get this question too, right? Like, correlation versus causation. How do you know that, like, the metrics that you pull are not reverse causation where, like what you said? But, like, I have a similar point of view. Like, even if we're going to say that it is reverse causation for a moment, and it's because customers are more successful with the product and are renewing more often and are adopting more frequently, they're also using education. So what? Then you would say education is a requirement and an expectation of those customers to be successful with your product, because what would they do if you didn't have education?
Right. Right. Exactly.
Right. That's circular. It's like circular causality, but that's okay.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, one of my favorite times when we actually got some really meaningful data at an organization that I had was the customers who used education had, you know, X percent greater success rate. I think it was, we were using revenue in that case. Customers who used professional services had X percent greater success rate. And then customers who used both it was like exponential. And that was like, that's the thing, is like your customer experience programs should feel seamless to your customers and should be working together to get them where folks need to go. And so like education is just one component of it. And if I can tie metrics so that people think, oh yeah, she's worth keeping around and this team is like worth investing in, great. But really, like, it should be in partnership with all the other folks in your organization who are trying to make sure your customers are successful.
Yeah. And that's helpful because on one hand, it gives you like a, you know, the soundbite that you can share with your sales team to help promote education and
absolutely,
to the executive sponsors and all of that. But it's also interesting because it gives you signals about what's working and about like what the characteristics of a successful customer engaging with education is. So you can do more of that, right? You can like focus on the areas that are already having higher signal strength.
Exactly. Yeah.
I'm curious, just before we move off the metrics topic, like from an enterprise versus PLG perspective, like are you seeing differences in the metrics that matter and then how that like relates to the educational programs you put together?
Yeah. I mean, one of the metrics that really mattered to us as a PLG organization was traffic. And traffic specifically to Webflow University. I mean, the numbers were pretty extraordinary, and driving as many people to Webflow University because it was the top of the funnel, and getting people into Webflow University meant they'd start learning our product and using our product and hopefully adopting our product and paying for it. That was, you know, that really mattered. And then the conversion rate from they come to Webflow University and now they're actually paying us for our product. Like that was the thing that really mattered more than anything else. And as opposed to they've already purchased, now you need to make sure they're successful as quickly as possible so that they can get the most out of your product and they love it and they feel good about it and they feel good about using it so that ultimately they're going to renew and they're going to expand. Yeah.
Yeah, makes sense. And also what I'm hearing is like it's not even just like the enterprise versus PLG thing. It's what does it mean for you to be an education team that operates from the very earliest moment, pre-sales, like you were talking about top of funnel, that means awareness, right? Customers becoming aware of your brand for the first time because they saw a video versus working with an account that has already made the purchasing decision. And like you mentioned way earlier in the conversation, where a lot of the users who are then responsible for being successful with your product may not have been anywhere near the purchasing decision. So they're just like, oh, hey, we got this product. What am I supposed to do with it?
Yeah.
Very different motivations at that point and yeah, very different metrics.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Cool. Last question before we start to wrap up.
Okay.
Let's talk about the future because already we've talked about this somewhat, that there's a lot changing in terms of how products are developed, in terms of the role that AI plays. We probably even called out a few more of these, but how do you think all of these changes that we're now seeing in the world are going to change the customer education space.
Yeah, I feel like I'm watching it in real time. And I, as I said with the question about like how the team is organized, I feel like my answer today is different than what it would have been 3 months ago and different what it's going to be in 3 months. And that's actually a big part of it. Like the only constant is change, except like now it's even faster. And so thinking about how do you develop your programs knowing that they're going to have to be faster, move at a faster pace, meet people who are also moving at a faster pace, who are also being required to deliver that much faster. AI is an interesting tool because it does make us more productive oftentimes, although it requires upfront investment to make that happen. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm an idealist. I am a believer in humans, as I said. Like, I think that's only as powerful as the hands it's in. So it becomes a question of how can we leverage this tool to do more of what we already know we need to do, or to, make it easier to do the things that are hard to do right now, or as opposed to replace humans. I'm not looking to replace humans, not to replace existing humans. Maybe it replaces some of the headcount that I might have asked for down the road, but only once we've really shown, we actually can do this with AI. I think that how people learn is changing already, and I've talked to my team about this. I watch a lot of Webflow University videos and courses. But when I'm sitting down and using our tool and trying to build something, I often go to ChatGPT and ask it specific questions as I'm going along, because it's very hard to refer back to a video to do that.
Learning is becoming way more contextual.
Yeah. Again, it doesn't replace that. The context is everything, right? Like still have to have that overarching understanding of what you're doing with this tool. There's still real value in traditional education, but there's a difference between how you're using that and what you're doing when you're actually in the tool, and how you can think about education, the just-in-time education, when they're actually sitting at their desks doing the work.
I don't have like a non-obnoxious way to say this, so maybe you have one, but I'm like,
okay,
you need a schema.
Yeah.
Nothing replaces having a schema for what you're supposed to do, because if you're using a new piece of software, you're asked to use a new task, like, yes, of course, you can click whatever in-app tooltips, you can read the docs as you go, you can ask ChatGPT as you go, but you're right, that's all contextual, that's all point in time. That doesn't replace that initial moment of almost like having this like topographical map in front of you, where you understand, like, if I'm getting from point A to point B, it's not enough for me just to see what this looks like in 2D. I need to understand where the mountains are, where the valleys are, like where the cougars live, all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And that's still, like, I would agree with you. There's still a role for like very like high value, engaging conceptual content. It's just like, we shouldn't expect that to also be the thing that people are like dual screening as they try to use the product.
Exactly. And that's always been a question and a challenge, is like, how do you give people what they need when they're actually sitting down and using your product? And I feel like, we might actually starting to move towards an answer for that we can rely on. And then it becomes, how do we make sure they're getting the right information in those moments if we're not controlling it? But the scaffolding is one of my favorite instructional design concepts. And like, one of the reasons why I think that there is a value in people who don't already know all of the answers being part of, I was having a conversation with somebody on my team about this, but being part of building education is you have to help people make that leap. You have to provide that context for them. You have to build the scaffolding for them. And it's very hard to do that if you already know all the answers. If I sit down and I just go straight into, and I mean, look, sometimes I do this. I'm like, okay, I don't want to learn. I don't want to spend time like doing formal education. I just want to start building and get my hands dirty. But oftentimes you hit a wall and you're like, okay, now I need to understand what it is that I'm doing. And I need to take a step back. And so how do those two things kind of live with each other?
Yeah, there's the sentiment that goes around sometimes. I see it especially in like customer success circles, but sometimes in other places where it's like customers don't want to like go through a university to learn how to use their product, to learn how to use your product. So, but then the question is like, so what? Then you have to look like within any of those posts, like, cause it's a hot take. It's like a good hot take. But it's like, then what are they recommending that you actually do? And then often what it's like is like, oh, build an agentic in-app guidance system. Build a AI co-pilot that just walks your customers through how to use the product, like in time as they're using it. Or just record all of your customer calls that you're having and cut out the part where the customer is speaking.
Oh.
And then you have your videos ready to go. And it's like just in time and it's quick.
Yeah.
And all that stuff bugs the ever loving shit out of me because we're swearing on this podcast.
I was just going to say, you've just decided you're going to really piss everybody listening off.
Well, we already gave the warning that there's category A swears. But like that's my I don't know how many times we can say this before YouTube age restricts us, but that's fine. We don't we don't need the Minecraft crowd watching this.
There.
No, but like it bugs me as well.
Yeah.
Because just is the operative word in
God.
Like yes, if we could just build what you're talking about, then of course that would be amazing. But like that stuff all takes a ton of work, and even if we invested all of our resources towards that, would we truly be solving the problem that you're calling out by saying like customers don't want to use an academy, which is also like a generalization.
Exactly. And anytime somebody uses that can't you just, you have to turn it back on them and be like, well, can't you just make sure your customers renew? If you're talking to a customer success manager, like we all have skills that make us successful in our jobs. And if you could just, then we wouldn't have jobs. And that's we bring a lot to the table. So absolutely. Absolutely. One of the things actually that I've been thinking about a lot is we talked about this last week. So you built it, an AI thing. Now what? Like, I feel like there's all these products that are like, oh, you can build this AI thing or you can build a ChatGPT but it's like, okay, but now what? Like, how do I integrate it into the tool that I'm using? How do I use it? How do I teach other people how to use it? How do I make it meaningful? How do I evolve it? How do I adjust that? Like, you can build a Webflow website with AI. We have, an AI site builder, but like, how do I update it? I haven't learned anything about what I've built. And so it's a great tool, but it's much more powerful if you know what you're doing. So you can then go in and actually evolve or update it or make it something that is not just whatever it is that, because AI can just humans.
Yeah.
Humans
and like, I think here we're very aligned to each other in the sense that like we view AI as a tool. It's a useful tool. Mm-hmm. It's a tool that you need to be taught to use correctly, sometimes through trial and error, but like also, you can be taught. It is a skill. It's contextual. And I think to your point, like, I mean, I don't know if we'll see this in 2026, but I wouldn't rule it out because everything in the AI world has been moving so fast. But maybe we'll actually see some progress on the integration layer of AI so that some of the tools that exist right now that help you do some things that might be great from a prototyping perspective or might solve local tasks, but aren't really connected to each other yet, like depending on what we see with MCPs and integrations and things like that. Maybe 2026 will be a year where we truly get to like a much stronger integration layer and we can do some of those things that right now we're saying like, oh, why can't we just do that?
I'm going to leave here and go to our product and engineering org and say, can't you just like do that?
why can't you just do that? No, but like, I mean, let's see. Like, I'm actually optimistic that some of these things will come to life.
Yeah.
Well, cool. Bessie, is there anything we didn't talk about yet that you would want to
mention? Oh, I mean, there's a million things, but this has been a great conversation. I feel like I could talk to you for hours.
Well, then we may need a part two. But for now, I will say a genuine thank you to you for coming and sharing your wisdom and your expertise. And I think we also have to give a special shout out to Curtis and Stacy.
Yes. Thank you, Curtis and Stacy,
for running
you've done
all the
to make
production.
Me look as good and sound as good as I do.
For all of the initial setup and troubleshooting and all of that, it's no small feat to get production going.
Yeah.
And we'll also say special thank you to Alan Coda for our theme music that is probably playing under me right now, even though on our podcast app, we don't put it in there. If you want to learn more, listeners, we have a podcast website at customer.education where you can find show notes and other material. And if this helps you out, you can help us out by like and subscribe, by subscribing to our show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you leave us a positive review on Apple Podcasts, those 5-star reviews really help us spread the word about what we're doing. And of course, to our audience, thanks for joining us. Go out and educate, experiment, and find your people. Thanks for listening. Thanks, Bessie.
Thank you.